He says I am a loser.
Worthless. Unattractive.
Stupid.
Crazy.
Selfish. Broken.
Ungrateful.
Damaged.
Frigid.
Unsupportive.
A bad wife.
A bad mother.
A bad daughter.
Nothing without him.
You don't have to let your partner's voice tell you who you are. If you are being abused, you can get help.
Call 1-800-799-SAFE or go to thehotline.org.
Let your voice be heard.
Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, and Delilah Jones, President of Imagine Publicity, my co-host joining you this evening, Saturday evening, each and every Saturday. And I'm coming to you from the state of Connecticut, and Delilah is there in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. So good evening, everyone, and welcome to Shattered Lives. It's always a pleasure to have you. And as we're on the doorstep of fall here, I have to tell you that we have a very special guest this evening from sunny San Diego. And her name is Leslie Peterson. She's a licensed clinical social worker, as well as a registered play therapist and a bilingual trauma therapist. And she comes to us from the Chadwick Center at the Ratty Children's Hospital in San Diego. And tonight we're going to speak about a topic that we haven't spoken too much about with regard to this show, so I'm very excited about being able to have this as a forum this evening. And before I do, I wanted to mention that we did do another domestic violence IPV PSA, and to just let you know that our guest was very fortunate to be a presenter with regard to her Kids and Teens in Court program at an international conference on children exposed to domestic violence in Taipei, Taiwan, a couple of years ago. So I think that is very relevant. So before we bring in Leslie, I just want to say good evening, Delilah. How are you, and what did you get to say?
I'm doing great, Donna. Thank you. As every week, thank you for having me on as the co-host and producer of the show. So I always enjoy my time here, and you've always had such wonderful guests, and today is no exception. I think this is definitely a topic that is a little underutilized or underspoken about, so I'm very excited to have Leslie with us and go right into it.
Yeah, for sure. So without further ado, Leslie, good evening and welcome to Shattered Life. It's a pleasure to have you.
Good evening. Thank you.
Well, it's our pleasure. And let's see, we've got a number of topics to tackle this evening, and we'll try to do our best. And then we have the blog forthcoming. So let's see. You are a very accomplished woman in many aspects, and I guess we're going to try to focus on your Kids in Court program because it is very innovative, and it's something that I understand you wrote the curriculum for. And tell me if I have my facts straight here. I just want to give a little bit of the background with regard to your center. I understand that it was founded in 1976, and initially it was just to have a facility for people to go when there was physical abuse to do medical evaluations and prevention. And then didn't it kind of evolve after a while in that you got more into a holistic treatment model? Is that correct?
Yeah. Initially, we were called the Center for Child Protection, and then later the center changed names after Dr. David Chadwick, who helped found the center. So now we're known as the Chadwick Center. And we primarily specialize in trauma and abuse. And it is holistic in that it tries to be sort of a one-stop shop. We do the forensic and medical exams and interviews there. We have a professional education department where we go out and put on trainings and workshops. We host a conference every year. And one of our biggest programs is the trauma counseling program, and that's where I work.
Mm-hmm. And with respect to that has evolved over a number of years for a particular need, right? In terms of the demographics of where you are, can you kind of describe what the community is like that you serve and what the needs were and why this was founded?
The trauma counseling program?
Yeah, that, in addition to the kids in court program that we'll be talking about specifically.
Yeah, Kids in Court, initially it was just a partnership between the district attorney's office in San Diego and the Chadwick Center Trauma Counseling Program. We found that we were treating a lot of the same kids and doing it very, very separately. So we saw the kids in therapy at our center, and they were going to be testifying in court and working with the DA's office. So that partnership began, and really just to help support the child's experience of testifying in court. And what it is today is a very, formalized program, and we have a new curriculum, so we follow a set agenda and structure for the work we do with the kids.
Mm-hmm. And why is it, now I had the benefit of being at one of your presentations at NOVA, and it was very helpful, but why is it when you have your typical court preparation and maybe in a particular area of the country they don't have something as developed as your program, why is it that just having a tour of the court for the child and meeting a couple of the players, why is that not enough?
I think what sets our program apart from other kids in court or kids go to
mm-hmm.
court programs is my background is as a trauma therapist. And really at the Chadwick Center, we are all specialists in our field, and we have a great deal of training and knowledge about trauma and trauma-informed services and child traumatic stress. So we really understand the needs of children and families from that end. And I don't
mm-hmm.
think that you can tease the two apart when you're working with a child who is going to be testifying in court for a potential abuse that they suffered or witnessed. They're traumatized
mm-hmm.
children, and they have trauma symptoms. So what sets our program apart is we've structured it to be very trauma-informed and sensitive to those needs that kids have. So the specific interventions that we use are tailored to address those symptoms and needs. And nothing is just done because it's fun or we think kids might enjoy it. Everything is very thoughtful. All of the activities that we do, they're based on current research in the field. So it's very tailored to address trauma and traumatized children.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful. How long is the particular process in terms of you have this child that's going to be going through the court process and the extended family or the caretakers involved? Would this be when you start working with a child day one? How long maybe it's very individual, but is there a typical time in terms of, or it's going to take us, 3 or 4 months to acclimate this child and this family to what they need to know?
We just based on limited resources, and many agencies right now are working under limited resources, we do very short-term treatment. And I think what we found a sweet spot of being able to intervene and help these kids and families as much as we can with the limited amount of time and resources that we have. So what we do is...
So it's very intensive in a short period of time, like a couple of weeks, or what's the sense of it?
It's about a month that we work with families. We offer a few options. Ideally, we have three groups every Thursday evening. And so we want families to come through all three of those groups, and they build upon each other. And they're given different information and different activities, and they, on some of the groups, they see the actual courtroom and have that experience. So for most of the cases, we're working with kids only for a month at a time.
Okay. And how best, because this is radio, and we're trying to visualize, could you kind of walk us through maybe the protocol with, what you would do with a young child versus, and I understand from having heard your presentation how it may differ from working with a teen, just in terms of hitting the highlights of what the actual process is with those different age groups?
Sure. And again, sometimes we're delivering, just because of limitations, we're delivering the same intervention, the same activities to all age groups, and we do our best. The basic structure of the activities that we do are going to be the same across developmental levels and ages. And what we would do to adjust for the different ages is introduce it in a different way. So, for example, one of the biggest activities that we do with kids, and this is from cognitive behavioral therapy, is we try to help them replace their negative thoughts about going to court with more positive ones. So for the littler ones, we call them Tigger thoughts. And, of course, we don't introduce it that way with the teens. So for the littler kids, right, for the littler kids, they'll color a picture of Tigger and write in the thought bubble their positive thought about court, which could be, court's going to be fine, I'm going to be okay, I'm brave, and that's what we'll do with the younger children. With the older kids, probably starting around 12 and on, we, instead of calling them Tigger thoughts, we call them power thoughts, and we still talk to them about thought replacement and the difference between positive and negative thoughts. And instead of having them color a page with Tigger on it, we have them create these affirmation boxes, which the teens just love. They're just little boxes that I got at our local craft store, and I bring out markers and glitter glue and just all kinds of different arts and crafts supplies, and they create this affirmation box. And inside, they write their positive thoughts on slips of paper to deposit inside their boxes. So it's the same premise. We're still teaching them the cognitive triad, the connection between their thoughts, feelings, and actions, helping them come up with a positive thought, but it's done in a different activity that's more suited to the different ages.
I see. Yeah, that it seems like it would be tailor-made for those kinds of activities, and you can get those types of materials just at any, dollar store or what have you. So, go ahead.
I was just going to ask a question about the different types of victims that you're dealing with in the trauma-informed therapy. Would it change, or, what I'm thinking, the line that I'm thinking on is you have, of course, abuse victims in a domestic violence situation or sexual abuse, and then you have human trafficking victims, which from my understanding, it's kind of a totally different approach, simply because the trauma that they were exposed to was not just a one-time event or a two-time event. It's an over and over daily event that goes on, for a long, long time. And I was just wondering, how do you address those types of victims at any age, whether they're, whether they're children, which a lot of them are, and some of them are young adults, and some of them, could be into their 30s or 40s.
In terms of the therapy that they're provided at our trauma counseling program, I think that's going to vary quite a bit depending on the type of trauma and the severity of their symptoms. And what we know is that children who, one, have experienced an abuse at the hands of someone who's in a caretaker role, that may create more severe trauma symptoms or more complex trauma. And then two, if it is a more chronic trauma experience where it's happened over the course of several years, many different times, as opposed to just a one-time traumatic event. So those are things when they're going through therapy, the therapist is going to tailor and adjust the treatment that they provide to address those specific things for that individual or that child. With the Kids and Teens in Court program, we're not getting into the – we try to stay very neutral and seem unbiased. So we're aware of what everyone's crime is, just, you know, because if there's any issues of a child is having suicidal thoughts, or for our own safety and for the client's safety, we try to have a basic awareness of what's going on with them. But regardless of what they're going to court for, we're still providing them the exact same interventions.
I see. So it's kind of a homogeneous atmosphere in terms of when you're doing these activities in a group. So but then they also get one-to-one therapy, correct, Leslie?
Right. Yeah. And so that's where we. What's really neat about our program is we try to be that bridge between, and I think there needs to be some kind of bridge between the district attorney's office and the legal side of everything, and then the therapeutic side of everything. Most families that we work with at Kids in Court, you know, it's still very new, and they're still in that crisis stage of everything, and most of them are not involved in therapy yet. Which okay. We recommend, you know, anytime something like this has happened, we always recommend families get into therapy or at least get an assessment or do an intake just to see what the needs might be. And we really try to be that liaison between the two worlds and help connect these families with our trauma counseling office and help them get into therapy with us in our office.
Yeah. Well, can you give us a sort of like a generic real life example in terms of from, you know, intake to what you did with this client week one, week two, how they progressed through the various modules, if I can use that word, and then when you actually introduced the family and the family members in the process too, and what you do, so we can kind of get a generalized picture of the progression of the program?
Sure, yeah. And I think what is really neat about our program is our Kids and Teens in Court program and then our trauma counseling program work so well together. We're housed in the same office. And oftentimes we share clients. And so we really try to work together to help the family. And then our partnership with the DA's office, too. I think families who successfully come through all of this, they really feel that there's this team around them. And that's what we aim to provide to these families. I think when I gave the talk at the NOVA conference, I shared one of our recent success stories about multiple families who hadn't been involved in a sexual abuse crime. So there were multiple child victims, and the case was picked up by the district attorney's office, and we initially, you know, immediately got the referral at the Kids and Teens in Court program, and we contacted the family. They were not at that time involved in therapy, or I think they were on a wait list either at our office or somewhere else, and because of their involvement with Kids in Court, we were able to help triage them and bump them up on the wait list, so they got into therapy right away. And all of, I think there were about five or six children total, and they came through a full cycle of Kids in Court. So the first night we meet with kids, we separate the kids and the parents, and we provide the kids the night one activities and night one curriculum that we have, which is just a basic overview of the courtroom, the roles, the cognitive positive thoughts and relaxation skills, and then we teach the exact same to the parents, but we're doing it separately on the first night, and then the second night we take everyone down to the courthouse here in San Diego, well, one of our courthouses, And we do a review with everyone together in one of the children's waiting rooms. And then we separate everybody again into separate courtrooms. And the kids just get to have fun and play in their courtroom. We go through a role play. So, and I have a judge's robe that I have that kids get to wear and pretend to be the judge. Someone is an attorney. Someone else gets to be the bailiff. And then we just go through and rotate and play all night in the courtroom. And the parents meet with a real deputy district attorney, and they get to hear from that person more about the court process, and they get to ask just general questions about the process. And then on the third night, we are at the courthouse again, and we do our review all together again. And then instead of splitting up, we all go into one courtroom, and we have a volunteer judge, and all of our judges are just so wonderful, and they volunteer their time late in the evening, and they preside over this mock trial that we put on. And so myself and my staff, we take on the roles, and then we have our judge presiding, and we call the kids up one at a time to testify and just ask them very neutral, fun questions about themselves and their likes, and we also ask them questions about what they've learned at Kids in Court. And typically that's
so
the last...
So is it scripted, Leslie?
It's not scripted, but we do follow a set curriculum, the curriculum that I introduced at the NOVA conference. So we have certain things we do on night one, and we always do those certain things. We have certain activities we do on night two, and then certain activities we do on night three. But it, you know, it varies with each group. We try to also tailor it to the group that we have.
Okay. And okay, so that covers those three nights. And the parents are in a separate one, except or the last night they all come together in one courtroom.
Yeah, the first night, the first and second night, the groups are separated. So kids go with the kids and parents go with the parents. And then the third night is everyone all together the whole evening.
Okay.
And it's neat for the parents. The parents get to see their child testifying on the stand. And they, you know, that's good practice for them because they may end up being the support person for their child or be in the audience the day their child goes to court. So it's good practice for them to get to experience what that might be like, too. And these parents have a great deal of anxiety just
sure.
as the kids do.
Yeah. Do you find that having the parents in there is a help or a detriment, or can it go either way depending on the family?
You know, I think it can go either way. We have kids who absolutely, you know, when we talk to them about their right to have a support person, they immediately say, oh, I want my mom there. And we have amazing parents that we've worked with who are just so strong and resilient, and they're able to really be there as a rock for their kids. And then we have those parents for whatever reason who are just really impacted themselves. And I've seen parents just during the mock trial break down and you know, come to have tears, it has to impact the child on the stand, and we see it happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that must be very difficult. I know that you spoke on the idea of, you know, people have the idea, or, you know, we've heard it on Law and Order all the time, that this experience is much too traumatic for a child and can damage them for life. Can you kind of debunk that myth, if it in fact it is a myth? What does the research show with regard to that?
Yeah, and I think, you know, every child is so different and unique, and it's very difficult to make that statement and say that testifying in court and having this experience poses long-term damage or is more traumatizing. It's hard to generalize that with these types of cases and these types of kids. What the research shows is there's so many factors that come into play. It's impossible to know if it's just the act of sitting on the stand and answering questions, or if it's just having to face the defendant. There's so much, and it's so much more complex. And what I have seen is the majority of kids who come through our program and go through all three sessions and also have trauma therapy in addition to that and have a supportive family, I have not seen their trauma symptoms increase.
Mm-hmm. That's very encouraging. Am I correct in the information that I read that your specific program serves about 200 families a year in this program?
Yeah.
Is that right? And so that in San Diego proper or around that area?
That is including, that's San Diego City, but also including San Diego County. Mm-hmm. We go down south to our southern cities, which are still part of San Diego County. There's a courthouse close to the border where we hold a once a month kids in court session, and we serve families from that demographic as well.
Imperial Valley?
We can. I don't know that we get many referrals from Imperial Valley.
Mm-hmm.
Most of our South County families are coming from Chula Vista or National City.
Okay.
And then that number also includes, we serve children who are involved in dependency court in addition to being involved in criminal court. So many times these families are involved in two different court systems, and children may have to testify in two different court settings.
Can you explain what you meant by that, the dependency court?
Yeah, there's the criminal court is for criminal side of it to determine if the defendant has or has not committed this crime. And then once a police report is filed or generated that a child abuse has potentially taken place, Child Protective Services automatically becomes involved and they're alerted and they investigate whether or not they substantiate the case, CPS, and sometimes they have to make the decision to remove the child from the home. And that gets them involved in dependency court. So what dependency court is when a child has been removed from the home by Child Protective Services, and then that court is to determine placement or visitation. Within that court system, they also terminate parental rights if that's needed. And sometimes, not super often, but sometimes they will call the child to testify in that court setting. So we work with those.
So they may have to testify in two different courts, is that right?
Yes.
Wow, that's a lot. And do they actually have to face their accusers, or is it done via video, Skype, or, I mean, tell us about that aspect.
In dependency court, there's not the – it's a little bit more flexible. Children can testify in closed chambers in dependency court, and it's the courthouse is closed. It's not an open to the public. In criminal court, at least in San Diego County, and my understanding is that this is the case for most counties in the United States, that children or anyone is testifying in front of the defendant because of the confrontation clause that exists in our Constitution, that a defendant has the right to face his or her accusers. So that includes, in cases of child abuse, children who have allegedly been victims of abuse are testifying in front of that defendant.
How is your preparation geared for that event, you know, knowing that that's going to probably be the most traumatic part of it? Is there specific things that you do to prepare the child to say, oh, you know, the bad person is going to be there, but you'll be protected, and this is how, or whatever?
Yeah, exactly. We, you know, I think, and I can see why adults do this. No one wants to upset a child. So a lot of times when kids come through kids and teens in court, they're not aware that the defendant will be in the courtroom. No one has told them or explained that to them. So we oftentimes are the bearers of the bad news, and we're the ones who explain that to them. And we really try and talk that through and encourage them to share any feelings that they're having about that. And I think what helps the most, you know, if that's the reality that they're faced with, what helps the most is being able to experience the courtroom setting and see more or less where they'll be sitting in proximity to where that person might be sitting, what the actual room is going to look like and feel like. In addition to that, we teach kids specific relaxation techniques that they can use if being in front of that person is bringing up a lot of strong feelings for them. We teach them some relaxation skills that they can do on the stand to calm themselves down. We also talk to them about their rights in the courtroom. They can take a break if they need to. If they feel uncomfortable, they can tell someone that they feel uncomfortable, that's allowed. Really just to give them, I think, you know, with these, and mostly we're working with sexual abuse, so I think this is especially true for sexual abuse. It's such a disempowering experience and trauma. And what we try to do is give the kids, through our preparation, give them back some of that power, knowing that they have rights, knowing that they can say, I need a break, knowing that they're really in charge in the courtroom when it's their turn to testify. I've seen that really make a big difference for these kids.
Yeah. Do you have a sense that the people that are overseeing the judges today, because there's children involved, are they more empathetic to the rights of the victim, would you say, with children as opposed to if it were adults? I mean, I've had my own experience, and we always think that, you know, all the rights are for the or most of them are for the perpetrator. But with children, how is that aspect of it?
My experience is mostly with the volunteer judges that we have, and some of them, or all of them really, have had some experience sitting on, presiding over criminal trials. Not all of the volunteer judges we have currently do that, but they're all, and we have probably anywhere from 12 to 15 judges each year who volunteer. They take one night a month, and they're just very delicate with the children during the mock trial that we do, that they preside over. Very reassuring, very, you know, soft tone of voice. Asking them questions, making eye contact with them. I've seen them really take a very delicate delicate touch with these kids. And something I tell the families that I work with when they come through our program is almost all of, you know, it's a fair assumption that most of the adults in the courtroom when kids do go to court are going to have kids themselves. And I don't know that as a parent you can be a parent and then, you know, also be in the situation where you're seeing a child testify in court and not be sensitive to that and that child.
Right. Well,
going back to the Crawford versus Washington issue with the perpetrator, or, you know, facing the accused in court, this is something, document the abuse and the evidentiary abuse affidavit goes directly into and circumvents Crawford versus Washington. And I'm wondering if something like this could be used so that these kids don't have to go through that kind of trauma. I can't imagine anything worse than having to face that, you know, that abuser again in court, even if you are the accuser. Could that testimony not be videoed, documented, and notarized as testimony?
I think it's such a complicated issue. And from what I've been told, that it doesn't seem that would change anytime soon. Definitely the families that we work with, that's really the number one fear, is seeing this person. There's many fears. The number one is seeing the defendant. And especially in cases involving sexual abuse, because some 85 to 95% of the abusers are caretakers or or known, at least, to the child. They're not strangers. That really complicates it when you're testifying in court about something that you know, very delicate natured event that happened to you, and the defendant happens to be your biological father, and
right.
you're aware that there's the potential for them to go to prison, and you're providing very necessary testimony. That's beyond trauma. That's just a really complicated dynamic.
It is very complicated, but you know, but going back to the law in Crawford versus Washington,
mm-hmm.
where you know it's basically to define hearsay, and
right.
you know,
right.
there again, the tool, the evidentiary abuse affidavit,
does. I think it would be a wonderful
does,
tool, Delilah. Yeah, I think
well,
if we
you know, it's working. It's the ideal, of course, it was designed for is domestic violence victims who, you know, have a very, very, very high risk of going missing or being murdered. So this is an extremely good tool for that. Has it been tested in court? No, it hasn't had to be. Thank
mm-hmm.
goodness, because, you know, if it was, that means somebody died. So as long as this tool has been out there and it's been used, we've kept these women alive, men or women. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, there again, going back to the hearsay evidence, if this testimony could be taken outside of the courtroom and it, circumventing all of that and have it not be hearsay, then why would that child have to be appearing in court?
Right. And I think for some children, this the act of testifying in front of the defendant who potentially is their parent or a loved one, it's a very difficult, and it could, you know, in a lot of cases it does exacerbate their trauma and trauma symptoms. And
sure.
and for other kids, it's maybe not as severe of a experience or doesn't create as severe of a reaction. There's such a wide range. And I think what the research shows is it's not simply the experience that these kids have going through this is not just solely about facing the defendant. There's so many other factors.
Mm-hmm.
And
but
so
if we could remove that trauma, so perhaps
right.
maybe we could, off air, we could introduce you to this material that we have and collaborate. Maybe there is someone that might be receptive to at least looking
mm-hmm.
at it, Leslie.
Yeah,
perhaps.
Well, I know that you know in California, in Los Angeles, attorney Robin Sachs
right.
has been using it
right.
effectively. So, you know, maybe if you can get in touch with Robin, she can explain it to you.
And I know that in London, Canada, there's a very extensive kids in court program there, and the issue there, they do not have the children testify in front of the defendant. They use shields, and I believe they do testimony in chambers or closed circuit. So their courtrooms
mm-hmm.
are very set up to be sensitive to the children and these issues.
I would love to
yeah.
see that here. I just think
yeah.
it's you know,
it's
very,
such an unnecessary
very
trauma.
It is.
I think if anything, it would remove one element of
right.
the process for kids. There's one less thing that they would have to worry about.
Right. So
exactly.
anything is good. So we'll see if we can get that accomplished. And you know, if someone there is receptive, because we have a lot of resources we can
mm-hmm.
forward to you as well, Leslie. But
right.
So thank you for that. And that's not taking away anything from your program, because I think from what I've heard, it's just, you know, it's stellar and it needs to continue. There's so much need. Can you touch on a little bit with regard, we've got about 20 minutes to our show, which is good, to the end of the hour. Do you, you know, you're serving so many roles. You're an LCSW, you're a play therapist, you're a trauma therapist. Do you actually, in working with the families and the children, with your interaction, do you actually have to go and testify in court in any of these cases?
Not in criminal court, and at least in San Diego, that's not common for therapist to be called to testify in a criminal court setting. Oftentimes I'm subpoenaed for family court or more often than not for dependency hearings to speak. And as a therapist, we really try to stay away from making any recommendations about any kind of placement or visitation or custody. But a lot of times we're called to testify about what children have said in therapy sessions that may be relevant to those court proceedings.
Right.
Okay. And I, you know, and having the experience of being subpoenaed and having to go to court or testify in court, I know how nervous I get. And I maybe get served once or twice a week at least. Every time I get one, it's a complete nerve-wracking experience. I can only imagine, you know, I'm an adult and a professional, and I do this for a living. I can only imagine how much stress these families feel when they're subpoenaed.
Right. Well, and you're right, and you know, kind of from both sides of the fence. So it is very nerve-wracking. But, you know, another aspect that I saw that was extremely interesting in the material that you had sent, because it kind of relates to a colleague of ours, well, not only Susan, who introduced the document, the abuse, but another female professional we know. The slide you have, how stress changes a child's brain, and with regard to the prolonged exposure of trauma and physiologic changes, and there's the greater associated risk of chronic disease and mental health problems and whatnot. And I'm looking at this slide about the changes in the brain and the fact that they can't regulate their emotions. I can think of at least two or three people that I know that definitely, you know, we know that these kind of things probably took place in their lives because of their extreme neglect. So could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure, yeah. Those images that I had on the slides from the talk were taken from Dr. Bruce Terry's website, and he's really the expert on trauma and how it impacts brain and brain chemistry and neurology. And really in a basic sense, when kids are, especially for chronic trauma, so when we're talking about children who are witnessing domestic violence, so that's, you know, ongoing over the course of possibly several years, there are periods of calm and then periods of explosion. Same thing for sexual abuse. There's periods of calm and then moments where a sexual abuse might happen. When that's happening over a prolonged period of time, the child's brain ends up being rewired in a way that it's not intended to. So we're not supposed to live our entire lives in a fight or flight state. And what happens when you're in a stressful or scary situation, those fight or flight chemicals are released in your brain. And then you go back to baseline. Most people go back to baseline and your brain shifts back. These kids are constantly in that fight or flight state, and it changes the chemistry in their brains. When I give talks and train interns to really try and understand this, and, you know, we just had Halloween, when you go into a haunted house, or when we have many of them here in San Diego, you experience that fight or flight, and you experience those the adrenaline and those chemicals. And then when you're out and you're done with it, you go back to normal. You don't stay there. That's typical. These children, it's like they're living their entire lives in a haunted house. They're always there. And so over time, that can really impact the brain and the body's ability to regulate and get back to a neutral, normal baseline.
Yeah. How have they done studies with respect to, now this one is a three-year-old child that with the slide. How common is this that these children are perpetually exposed to this fight or flight, you know, over a period of years? Is it
you know, 10% of the population, and then when they look at a longitudinal study, those are the people that are getting cancer and heart disease and die prematurely, et cetera. Can you extrapolate from there?
Yeah, you know, there's the really amazing brain in general is very, you know, malleable and has a lot of plasticity, and especially the child's brain. So even mm-hmm. if this is the case that they've been exposed to prolonged trauma and it's impacted their brain and brain chemistry, there's so much potential and hope to fix that with children. That is, if they get out of that situation and into treatment. There's another really great professional here in San Diego, Dr. Vincent Folletti. He works mm-hmm. out of Kaiser Hospital in San Diego, and he yeah. has been working on the ACE study for several years, the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study.
Right. We're familiar with that.
Yeah. And he's shown that, you know, there is a link between childhood trauma and trauma exposure and physical health down the road, and even diseases such as cancer. Definitely, you know, his study initially was an obesity study, so he showed a very strong link between obesity and childhood trauma or traumatic experiences.
Wow, so he's doing his research there in San Diego?
Yeah, it's been several years now, at least 10, probably more. Mm-hmm. I believe, and I've seen him speak many times. And initially he was the doctor out of Kaiser and was doing a research study that was only about, you know, focused on obesity. It wasn't necessarily focused on trauma. And what they just kind of inadvertently found was that many of the patients that they had in their study had these complex trauma childhood histories. And so they really expanded, and they were able to find all these different, the connection between different, what they call adverse childhood experiences and mm-hmm. later the health problems, physical health problems in adulthood.
It's just amazing that they have made that link, and we need to let people know in every way that we can that this does exist, and it's not just, oh, you know, you didn't eat right, or, you know, or whatever.
Right.
There's a definite link. So we want to continually beat that drum for the people that we know that have experienced that. That's very interesting. I'm going to look it up with regard to the obesity aspect as well. But can we segue a little bit to the I think a lot of people are familiar with some of the trauma symptoms, and children might want to go over some of that a little bit too. But also, I found something that was very practical in your material with the tips for helping children cope with the stress of the trial, just in terms of going down the list type of thing. What can you say about those elements that were in this list that you sent me on child sexual abuse, caring for kids?
So helping support children through the court process?
Yeah. Like maintain your normal routines. Expect the unexpected. These are kind of part and parcel for what you're doing, but maybe people don't really know, if they haven't been through a trial, what are the triggers that are the most stressful.
Right, and I think what complicates this is, and you know, I've been subpoenaed, I have that experience, and I know how stressful just the experience of going to court is and can be. And on top of that, for these kids, they're dealing with complex trauma symptoms or child traumatic mm-hmm. stress. So they've really got kind of this double whammy of issues and symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, part of what we do in our program too is help educate parents about just how to help support their child through their trauma symptoms. And part of that is trying to maintain normal routines as much as possible. Sometimes parents tell us that they feel badly disciplining their kids after everything else that they're going through. And that's absolutely not going to do their child any service or benefit. So we talk to parents about you can't change the rules at home just because they're involved in court or because they've been sexually abused. You still have to have the same rule that you can't hit your little brother, and there has to be a consequence for hitting their little brother. So that, you know, and that I think is something that parents, it's hard for them to, they struggle with that.
Makes sense.
And, you know, the other piece I think is really important is for parents to be very honest with kids. And I don't think in our culture that's really emphasized as we try to shield children and protect them from scary things. But it's better for them, for the kids to have all of the information at an appropriate, you know, level for them to know. So with court, parents need to talk to their kids and tell them that they're involved in court and that they will have to go to court. I can't even count the number of times that we've had families come through Kids in Court and the parent hasn't had that conversation with their child. Or they even lie to them about why they're coming to our program. So it's, you know, it's very important to be honest and upfront with kids and give them information that's developmentally appropriate for where they're at.
Yeah, I would, because it's really doing them a disservice if you don't. And I was just wondering with regard to the actual, you know, how do people qualify for the program? Is there a waiting list? Does it depend on the type of case or the complexity? And my understanding is you were out of, what is it, 75 employees, you're the only paid person. Is there a way to donate to the program? Because we certainly want to get, you know, that out there too. If people would like to give donations if possible, or how is that? You know, how do they qualify?
Kids and Teens in Court is a sub program of our trauma counseling department at Chadwick.
Yeah.
So and I think I mentioned in my talk it is kind of a one-woman show. I'm the only paid employee, and I have one volunteer who's been with me for many years, and she's wonderful, and then two student interns who are forensic psychology students, and then one per diem staff who helps out just during the groups. So our program is very tiny, and we're able, with very limited resources and money, we're able to serve 200 families a year. We serve anybody. There's no, you know, they have to be involved in not even criminal court proceedings, but some court proceedings. The majority of our referrals do come from the district attorney's office, directly from their DDA or their victim advocate. Then many of our referrals come from social workers or from therapists. We've had families just kind of find us and through the internet or word of mouth and contact us themselves. So we don't necessarily need to have a referral. Our program is free of cost, so we don't, you know, it's a completely voluntary free program, and we don't turn anyone away. And also their families are eligible if they come through one cycle of the program. So they come to those three sessions that month and they feel like they need more. We'll offer them welcome to come back through. So we've had some families come 2 or 3 months in a row or come for the group sessions and then maybe do an individual with us right before their court date. So it's really a pretty open program.
Yeah, it sounds like you accomplished a lot with very few resources, which is highly commendable in this day and age. You have to be creative, right? You sure do. And, you know, the other couple of things, I was reading that, you know, you do have a particular scale that you use to assess their level of stress and the fact that after you finish the program, if you try to gauge what their anxiety is afterwards, was it something like 87% was they're less anxious than when they started? Is that right?
Yeah, we about three years ago, we started using the child the court-related stress scale for children. CRSS, and it was developed by Dr. Rebecca Nathanson. I believe she's out of UCLA. So we got permission from her to use this assessment measure. And before that, we were using other measures, but I don't think they were really capturing specific court anxiety, which is what we target. So this measure is specific about court-related anxiety. So not necessarily trauma anxiety, but just about going to court. The questions are specific to court. So we administer it's a very simple questionnaire. We administer it to every child. Every time they come to us, they get the questionnaire at the very beginning of the session and then at the very end of the session. And then at the end of the month, we take their initial pretest, the very first one, and then the very last one that they ever did, and compare. So at the beginning of coming through our program, what was their level of anxiety? And then at the very end of our program, at that point, what is their level of anxiety? And we've had amazing results. And even after just one session, kids show a significant decrease in their anxiety. So that really shows that, you know, our program
works. You're doing something right, Leslie.
Yeah.
That's great. You must be so proud. You know, and what I wanted to ask, because we've only got a couple of minutes, if, you know, someone's listening in, I don't know, Nebraska or wherever, I mean, how many places across the country is this replicated in? And if they have a family member or know of a family that is dealing with a child of abuse, of domestic violence, sexual assault, and, gee, we don't have that neat program like they do in San Diego, what would be your recommendation?
Well, because our program has evidence and data to back up that it really does work, and it's trauma-informed, my understanding, as far as I know, is we're the only ones using this standardized curriculum that we've
really?
Developed and created.
Wow.
We spent the last year creating this manual, this curriculum, so that our goal, my hope would be that every kids in court program, every DA's office, every child advocacy center who's working with these families is using our evidence-based, trauma-informed curriculum. So we have it available.
Well, now's your chance to give us your phone number and address.
Yeah.
You'll be busy.
So we have a website. It's the Chadwick Center Kids in Court on there, and our curriculum will be available to purchase through the website. The easiest way is probably just to call me or email me. My phone number at the Chadwick Center is 858-966-8682.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then my email is L-M as in Marie, Peterson. S-O-N at rchsd.org.
That's great, because I think there are a lot of professional people out there, too, that might be interested in your model. And I saw the curriculum. It's very impressive, and I think other people are needing to use it. So it is good. What would be your message that you would like to convey in terms of parting words here, overall message in terms of what you do to people out there if they're victims themselves and they know other people?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think before I started working in this program, I was one of those people who thought that testifying in court and going to court was the worst possible experience a child could go through, and it was so devastatingly traumatic.
Yeah.
And I've seen so many kids come through our program and laugh and smile and have fun, and I don't think that this is the hardest thing that they'll ever have to do. I think that it's, you know, with proper preparation and support, it's not as impactful an experience as it has to be.
Well, that's a good testimony for your program and everything that you do. And we want to thank you so much. This hour's really quickly gone by. We'd like to talk
to you
out there as well. But so we're going to have to close this out for this evening. So I say thank you so much, Leslie. Thank you, Delilah. And stay tuned for Black Tomorrow and another session next Saturday of Shattered Life, everyone. Have a good and a safe evening. Okay,
take care.
He says if I leave, he will kill me.
He was sobbing and swore it would never happen again.
He's under so much stress. I'm really the only one who understands him.
He says he can't live without me.
I have nowhere else to go.
nobody would believe me.
If you are in an abusive relationship, it often feels as though you've lost your voice. You deserve a better life, and there is help.
Call 1-800-799-SAFE or go to thehotline.org.
Let your voice be heard.